die, Carter, is nothing left. Since I was a child, I had a feeling of something is missing in me. I want to know why I'm here. Can any of us know that?
Become yourself. Then God and the devil don't matter.
I want to know. I want to understand. Be careful. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lives to live together in your life? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb.
And you must learn what it means to become responsible.
This is an exact right. And that is why you are here.
Tuning in once again. If you're with us for the first time, please take some time to look at our website, redeyescreations.com, for not only more radio, but to get a better grasp of what we do and the kind of topics that we cover. My name is Henrik Palmgren. We are based out of the old country of the Goths in Sweden, on top of the European continent, and we're doing our very best to highlight some of the most important and interesting subjects that we come across. Our topic today, the fluoride fraud. We have Dr. Paul Connett with us. He is a graduate of Cambridge University and holds a PhD in chemistry from Dartmouth College. Since 1983, he taught chemistry at St. Lawrence University in Canton, New York, where he specialized in environmental chemistry and toxicology, but retired in 2006. Paul has researched the literature on fluoride's toxicity and the fluoridation debate for about 17 years. He helped found the Fluoride Action Network and has given presentations on the dangers of fluoridation to legislative and research bodies around the world. This has included invited presentations to both the U.S. EPA and the U.S. National Research Council. With two other authors, he published the book The Case Against Fluoride in 2010. In the first hour, we discuss fluoride propaganda and science. We'll hear about the history of fluoride from dental research to economic interests, including the collusion between the U.S. government and fluoride producers. Paul talks about the dangerous effects of fluoridation, ranging from arthritis to brain damage, and what can exacerbate its effect. Connett further discusses the true science behind fluoridation and the CDC's and EPA's knowledge of it. Stay with us for more. Well, welcome to Red Ice Radio, Paul. Thanks for coming on the program, first of all.
I'm delighted.
I am delighted as well. This is a very important topic, and I believe that we have not dedicated an entire program to this topic before, so this will be both informative and important, of course. Fluoride, when did you get involved in this, debate, I guess, Paul, if we can call it that at this stage?
Just under 17 years ago, my wife, Ellen, put a bunch of papers on my desk and gave me a cup of tea. I should have been suspicious. And she asked me, would I read these papers? And I said, well, what is it? And she said, oh, it's fluoridation. I said, take those papers away. These people are crazy. I had fallen victim of the propaganda that the people opposed to fluoridation are a bunch of crazies, flat earth society people. However, she was persuasive, and I did read the papers that she put on my desk, and quite frankly, I was both embarrassed and alarmed. I was embarrassed that I'd fallen victim of the propaganda that people opposed to fluoridation are crazy. And also, I was very disturbed by what I read. I was particularly disturbed by the fact that whilst fluoride is not very reactive chemically, it's like comparing salt with chlorine. Everybody knows that chlorine gas kills people and very poisonous. But chloride, sodium chloride, you sprinkle on your potatoes. And I felt that sodium fluoride would be similar relationship with fluorine. Fluorine is a nasty element, very reactive, reacts with every element except two noble gases, even reacts with asbestos. And if we were putting fluorine in the water, then of course it would be absolutely bizarre. But fluorine, I thought, well, that's not very reactive chemically, but the shock was to find that it's very active biologically. In fact, the first opponents of fluoridation were biochemists. Biochemists who'd use fluoride to poison enzymes in their experiments. And one of the early opponents of fluoridation was, in fact, Professor James Sumner from Cornell University, who got the Nobel Prize for enzyme chemistry. He said fluoride is a well-known poisoner of enzymes. We don't want anywhere near our bodies. So that was the first thing. And fluoride is extremely active, interferes with a lot of biology, poisons enzymes, interferes with hydrogen bonding, complexes with metal ions, which serve very important functions in biology, and so on. And the second thing I found out was another shock to me. The level of fluoride in mother's milk, mother's breast milk, the baby's first meal, is extremely low. And you know, when you think about it, baby's milk, mother's breast milk, this is what the baby needs for an ideal mixture of nutrients and minerals, etc. Everything the baby needs, assuming that the mother has a decent diet herself, because she can't make vitamins and she can't make minerals, but assuming she's got a decent diet herself, she's going to give her baby what exactly that baby needs for healthy development. But when you look at the fluoride levels in mother's milk, it's extremely low. I'll give you the concentration. 0.004 parts per million. Hmm. And to put that into perspective, we fluoridate between 0.7 and 1.2 parts per million in the water. So let's take an average. Let's just say the one part per million. Keep it simple. One part per million compared to 0.004 parts per million is 250 times higher. In other words, a bottle-fed baby in a community that's fluoridating its water, one part per million, is giving its baby 250 times more fluoride than a breastfed baby, or to put it another way, 250 times more fluoride than nature intended. And I, as a biochemist, or most of my training has been in biochemistry, it's very sensitive to that. Mother Nature has developed the most exquisite machinery. She is the best chemist that's ever existed. She's been experimenting for millions of years,
yeah,
and has come up with a pretty successful machine called a human being. And the very thought that a bunch of dentists in Chicago know more about what the baby needs than nature and her developmental mechanism called evolution is preposterous. So right then and there, within a short amount of time, I realized that fluoridation was not a good idea, and I've been working hard ever since to stop it, not just in the United States, but around the world.
Indeed, you're on the Fluoride Action Network. Fluoridealert.org is the website. We can talk a little bit more about that later and what you have on the website and such, but why don't we get into the history then of fluoride, because we're all wondering how this even became an issue to begin with. We don't have it in the water supply previously, and there is a very interesting history to fluoride. What do you know about it, Paul?
Well, there are two strands to this history. There's a respectable strand called dental research, and there's a less respectful strand called economic self-interest and industries protecting themselves from liabilities. And maybe we can throw in a third interest, which is the sugar lobby. But we'll save that to a little bit later. Let's look at the respectable strand to this history. Back at the beginning of the 20th century, dentists noticed a peculiar staining of the teeth in certain parts of the country, particularly in Colorado and Texas. And in those days, they called this staining of the teeth dental mottling. It took them a long time to find out what was causing this mottling, and eventually in 1931, three different research groups found that it was fluoride. So they changed the name to dental fluorosis, meaning literally poisoning of the teeth by fluoride, dental fluorosis. Now, whilst this was all going on, the dentist who was studying this mottling of the teeth said, it's rather strange, these teeth look awful, but there doesn't seem to be much tooth decay in them. So maybe whatever's causing this dental mottling may be protective of the teeth, of the enamel. And that's what prompted the U.S. Public Health Service to see if there was a level of fluoride in the water that would reduce tooth decay without causing too much dental fluorosis. And that's when Trenley Dean in 1942 produced his famous 21 city study. Why he limited himself to 21 cities, I do not know, because he had data from many more cities. Mm-hmm. But he maintained that at one part per million, you would reduce tooth decay without causing too much dental fluorosis. And he felt that about 10% of the kids would get dental fluorosis in such a mild form that only dentists would recognize it, parents wouldn't notice it, kids wouldn't notice it. So this 10% was considered a reasonable trade-off. And I'd like to run the clock forward, if I may,
sure,
to 2010, when the Centers for Disease Control, which is an avid promoter of fluoridation in the United States, reported that 41% of American children, and that includes children living in non-fluoridated communities, have some form of dental fluorosis. So the idea at the beginning was we'd only get 10% of the kids with very mild dental fluorosis. The reality today is that 41% of American children between 12 and 15 have some form of dental fluorosis. We can assume that the kids in the fluoridated community are going to have even more than that, because this is an average of children living in both fluoridated and non-fluoridated communities. And they're not all in its very mild condition. 8.6% of them have the condition which impacts 50% of the enamel, and 3.6% of them, it impacts 100% of the enamel. And when you get to those levels, you've got a situation which causes acute embarrassment for children, possibly psychological damage when teenagers don't want to open their mouths or smile during their first date and so on. Anyway, that's the current situation. So one part of this gamble has not worked out. Of course, the real gamble that was taken when the United States government actually endorsed fluoridation in 1950 was that whilst fluoride was causing this visible condition called dental fluorosis, what else was it doing? Did fluoride just choose to just interfere with the tooth cells? Did it not interfere with the baby's growing bone cells, mm-hmm. brain cells, endocrine system? And, of course, I think we're now beginning to find out that this gamble was indeed reckless, to assume that the only thing damaged was the teeth. And, of course, they can't deny that because you can see it. But you can't see with the naked eye damage to the bone or the brains and so on. And that's what we're beginning to find out. Incidentally, not from studies being done in the United States or any of the handful of countries which fluoridate, but countries which do not fluoridate their water but have high natural levels. They are trying to get the fluoride out of their water, and they are studying very carefully all the effects that fluoride can have on the body. We are not doing that. At this moment, it appears that those who promote fluoridation are more concerned about protecting this practice, this policy of water fluoridation, than actually looking scientifically at what it's doing to our people.
Yeah, indeed. Now, that's the dentistry angle to this. I remember an article I read some years ago now, also about the history of the atomic bomb and the connection to fluoride. What do you know about this?
Well, that's true. That's true. To make the atomic bomb, they used a huge amount of fluoride to make fluorine, which in turn was used to make uranium hexafluoride, and this gas was the way that they used that to separate the two isotopes of uranium, the fissionable stuff used in the bombs. separated from the non-fissionable type, the U235 from U338. So they use a huge amount of fluoride to do that. And in the process, there were releases of gases from this operation. And damage was caused to peach orchards in New Jersey and other places. And so right from the word beginning, the budding nuclear industry under the Manhattan Project was very concerned about future lawsuits. So they got involved. And in fact, the chairman of the committee that determined what turned out to be the second trial, but I think in 1943, they thought it would be the first trial, was in Newburgh, New York, with Kingston, New York as the control. Well, the chairman of the committee that set up this investigation was none other than Harold Hodge, the chief toxicologist of the Manhattan Project.
That's right.
And
wow.
This 10-year study, every day, the information of effects of fluoride were being fed to Harold Hodge in Rochester, and they wanted low-level exposure data for potential lawsuits. That's what we think was happening there. But that's only one part of an industrial complex that was concerned about fluoride. In those meetings in New York City in the 1940s, there were also representatives of many industries, like United Steel, Alcoa, aluminium industries, many metal industries, phosphate fertilizer industry.
Yeah.
And the thing they all had in common was that they either used fluoride in their manufacturing process, and fluoride is critical for the extraction of aluminium, for example, but also as a flux to reduce the temperature at which metals melt. So calcium fluoride or fluorspar is used a lot in these extraction processes. Anyway, the end result is that these companies were producing a lot of fluoride pollution, creating a lot of lawsuits from farmers who are having their cattle damaged, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I believe the major concern was not so much liabilities, although there were more lawsuits pertaining to fluoride air pollution than any other air pollutant in the 1940s. But it was concern about what they were doing to their workers and the potential liabilities from their workers. And so these industries were extremely interested in a way of, at least in the public's mind, changing the image of fluoride as being one of the worst air pollutants, one of the pollutants that have done more damage to agriculture than any other pollutant, to this fairly benign substance that would be safe enough to literally sprinkle on your cornflakes or add to your drinking water. And that whole history is documented by Chris Bryson in the Fluoride Deception. And Chris spent 10 years writing this book. He's a former BBC correspondent and producer. 10 years writing this book, and he dotted all the I's and crossed all their T's for those who think this is just a conspiracy theory. Here was a real conspiracy. If he has documented the correspondence between the U.S. Public Health Service and the Fluorine Lawyers Association. He can't wriggle out of that one. The Fluorine Lawyers Association were representing industries that were creating fluoride pollution, and they were facing lawsuits. Why on earth was the U.S. Public Health Service working with these guys? So there was collusion from the very beginning between the U.S. government and fluoride polluters. And it may have been, incidentally, that after World War II, they knew there would be a huge expansion in these industries like aluminium and steel and so on with the post-World War II economy. And they knew, perhaps, that one of the inevitable consequences of this huge economic expansion would be a fluoride pollution, and something had to be done to accommodate these huge economic interests. They couldn't be crippled by little concerns about what it might be doing to the health of the workers or to the health of the people that were exposed to this fluoride.
Yeah. Now, what do you make of this, the idea that they were trying to also maybe at the same time, as is horrible, of course, but getting rid of this waste product in some way? I mean, how it ended up both in the water supply and in the toothpaste and everything else. I mean, what was the reason, really?
No, I think the major driver here is liabilities. The companies were looking for ways to minimize the liabilities from any future lawsuits, particularly from their workers. I think the fact that they could get rid of some of the waste was an extra attraction,
yeah.
But it doesn't represent a huge amount of money. I mean, if you look at today, most of the fluoride chemicals that we use for fluoridation come from the phosphate fertilizer industry.
Yeah.
And people have calculated that's about $200 million, you know, give or take $100 million. About $200 million is saved by not having to get rid of it as hazardous waste, and then returns from sales to the public water utilities. Now, I don't think that $200 million worth of economic interest is the tail that's wagging the dog of the mighty public health service, or today we call it the Department of Health and Human Services. I do not think that they are literally carrying the torch for the phosphate fertilizer industry's economic interest. I think it's much more, in one sense, it's much more profound than that, and in another sense, I think it's more benign in that. I think it's more profound in as much as there's many other economic interests involved than the phosphate fertilizer industry. Going back to what we say, if today fluoridation of water at one part per million was declared to be unsafe, then, oh my goodness, wait for the lawsuits from workers in the aluminum industry and the phosphate fertilizer industry who are being exposed to much, much larger quantities of that every day of their working lives. And all those people out there that have been in hospital have had problems with their bones and everything else. I mean, I've met workers in the aluminum industry that could not lift their arms above their shoulders because their connective tissue has been sort of calcified out.
Wow. Yeah.
So I think that's the more profound interest. That there are many industries that are concerned about keeping fluoride's benign image and make it seem harmless of exposure. But the other one is more benign. I think the problem is, as Bill Hersey said, Dr. Bill Hersey from EPA says, they're riding a tiger. They don't know how to get off. They have promoted this now for 68 years. For 68 years, scientists in the U.S. government and professional bodies have said that fluoridation is completely safe and effective, and that the people opposed to fluoridation are a bunch of nitwits, and they've used their authority. They've used their authority to overwhelm public opposition here, and for them now to admit that they were wrong is going to be a huge hit on the public's trust. And I think that's where they are very concerned, and that's where I think you can see the kind of argument that is distasteful, that the end justifies the means. I think they're more concerned right now in protecting other public health practices. And if they are seen to have lied or deceived or just simply been wrong about fluoridation, after all this time, they're going to lose the public's trust, and it's going to be more difficult for them to continue other public health practices, which in the scheme of things, I think are far more important. So they may not feel that saving a fraction of one tooth surface, which is all it comes down to at best, that swallowing fluoride may reduce tooth decay by a fraction of one tooth surface out of over 100 permanent tooth surfaces in a child's mouth. That is not worth going to the wall for, you would think. But if in the process of protecting fluoridation, you felt that you were protecting, say, the vaccination program and the other big public health practices, they might feel that it was worth saving that skirmish on those issues to later. Let's defend the outer perimeter of fluoridation before we are forced to fight these other battles.
Wow, incredible. So what is the official science being pushed here on how it's beneficial to teeth, and I guess specifically children's teeth, Paul?
Well, the science is very straightforward on this. At high levels, fluoride kills the bacteria in the mouth that converts sugar into acid. So if you use fluoride in toothpaste, 1,000 parts per million, you can kill the bacteria in the mouth which cause tooth decay. At low concentrations, as used in water, at 1 part per million, you're not going to kill any bacteria. But those fluoride ions replace the hydroxide ions in the mineral of the teeth called calcium hydroxyapatite. And so the fluoride goes into the enamel, the OH minus comes out, and you get a new mineral, calcium fluoroapatite. And that is harder and more resistant to acid attack from the bacteria, again, converting sugars to acids, than the regular mineral. So that's the basic science behind it. The fluoride is working with the surface of the enamel to make the teeth more resistant to acid attack. But here we get to something that should have ended fluoridation in 1999, when the Center of Disease Control actually admitted what many dental researchers have been finding for about 20 years, that the major benefit of fluoride is topical, not systemic. Mm-hmm. Let's make sure what people understand. Topical means the fluoride works on the surface of the tooth, or the outside of the tooth, not from inside the body.
That's right.
Now,
yeah.
the moment they admitted that, they removed the rationale for swallowing fluoride and completely removed the rationale for putting it in the water, and also removed the rationale for forcing it on people that don't want it, because if the reaction is topical, then those who want fluoride, and I don't, but those who want fluoride can brush it on their teeth and spit it out. This way you can minimize the exposure to all the rest of the tissues in your body, and again, you're not forcing it on people that don't want it. So you're solving the medical problems, and you're solving the ethical problems. You're not violating the individual's right to informed consent to medication.
That's right. What is the reasoning then behind the water fluoridation, how this debate got started? It's like, oh, well, it will be beneficial to everybody because, you know, for the reasons that you just mentioned, then officially, this is how it will work. And is it specifically targeted for children in any way, or is it for everyone?
Well, that's what they thought. They thought in the beginning that if you swallowed fluoride, that for the baby, before the teeth have erupted through the gums, the fluoride would accumulate in the enamel, as I said, conversion of calcium hydroxyapatite to calcium fluoroapatite. So when the teeth finally emerged through the gums, they would be more resistant to acid attack, and you would get even more fluoride embedded in the enamel between the primary teeth and the secondary teeth. So that was the theory. But in 1999, as I've said, the CDC actually admitted, sorry, we were wrong. We used to think that we had to swallow fluoride at a very young age in order to strengthen the enamel before the teeth erupted. But they said not enough fluoride is actually absorbed during this period, and the major benefit is topical, not systemic. And so this whole notion, I mean, we had pediatricians, and some still are, pediatricians giving tablets to pregnant women and drops to babies, all in this process of trying to get fluoride to the growing baby before the tooth have erupted. It's all useless. And all that can happen is you're at very least increasing the risk of dental fluorosis, but also, as now new evidence indicates, that we may be harming the baby in other ways too. But unfortunately, because there's so much dogma attached to this practice, so much of this belief system, this is all that dentists and doctors are taught at dental and medical school, that fluoridation is safe and effective, completely harmless, people opposed to it, stupid, etc., etc. So they're so indoctrinated that they continue to do silly things like giving fluoride tablets to babies, and even sanctioning companies making a product called nursery water, which is designed to give to babies. It's bizarre, And it's sad, but this is what happens when politics interferes with science. When you drive a wedge between honest science and public policy, it's very serious indeed. And I think that's actually one of the most serious aspects of fluoridation. We're driving a wedge between honest science and public health policy, and in the process, for those with an open mind who actually read the literature, you're losing the public's trust. You're losing the public's trust, and I don't take that lightly. I think there's going to be a time in the future when we're going to need the public to trust their health agencies. Right now, I do not. I do not trust them, certainly not on this issue, and I suspect on others as well. And it's a pretty sad thing to have to say.
Indeed. Now, Paul, does it help to also then strengthen the teeth in some way? Does it help to, I don't know the scientific or medical terminology here, but I've heard from some people that it kind of works with, calcium in some way, that it strengthens the bone structure. How does that work, if that is the case?
Well, it's a two-edged sword, as far as the bones are concerned. About 50% of the fluoride that we take in each day accumulates in our bones. And certainly in the beginning, it hardens the bones. But with lifelong exposure, the danger is it also makes the bones more brittle. And so the real concern here, there are two concerns here in terms of fluoride's damage to the bone. The first symptoms of fluoride poisoning the bone in a disease called skeletal fibrosis, which impacts millions of people in India and China and other parts of the world which have high natural fluoride in their water. Skeletal fibrosis, the first symptoms are just like arthritis, stiffness in the joints, pains in the joints, even pains in the bones, but nothing showing up on x-rays. So a doctor who's not trained to recognize these symptoms as possibly indicating fluoride poisoning misses it completely and starts giving the patient, painkillers and everything else that we do for arthritis. And if you ask a doctor, "Doc, what's causing arthritis? What causes it?" He says, "You've got arthritis." "I've got arthritis." "Okay, so what's causing it, Doc?" The doctor says, "Well, we don't really know, but we think it's got something to do with aging." "Oh, well, there's something that also runs parallel with aging in a fluoridated community, and that's the number of years you've been drinking fluoridated water." Mm-hmm. "And after you've been drinking 30, 40, 50, even 60 years now, those symptoms of arthritis may be caused by fluoride. But guess what? No fluoridating country has ever done an investigation is to see if this epidemic of arthritis, I think one in three American adults now have this condition, no studies to see if there's any link at all with fluoridation. Their attitude is if you don't look, you don't find. That protects the policy. And the conclusion, the absence of study is the same as absence of harm, which of course it is not. It's really, again, very serious, and it reflects, again, the fact that politics is interfering with normal science here.
What are some of the health problems then that arise? You mentioned some of the issues, of course, but there's ways we can expand on this. I know that the people, as you said before, the works with fluoride, developing the chemical, if you will, they get bone cancer, all kinds of, weird problems. So how does it harm, both babies, children, and adults, Paul?
Well, even though you're being very generous with the amount of time that you're giving me, I'm not going to be able to cover all bases here. But let me just tell your readers, if I could, that I've written a book on this with two other scientists, James Beck, an MD, PhD physicist from Calgary, Alberta, and Spedding Micklem, a biologist who taught at the University of Edinburgh. And this book is called The Case Against Fluoride. It's published by Chelsea Green. It's available on Amazon.com. So those who want chapter and verse on this can read our book. There are other things that they can read, too, on our website. There's a huge health database. But let me go through some of the things. We've mentioned dental fluorosis. We've mentioned the possibility of arthritic symptoms, and if the fluoride continues to accumulate in the bones, maybe hip fractures in the elderly. There are mixed studies on that. Some studies say yes, some say no. doctors used to use fluoride in the 30s, 40s, and 50s in Argentina, France, and Germany to lower the thyroid activity of people with hyperthyroidism, overactive thyroid gland, and it was effective. And the doses that they used to lower the activity of the thyroid gland were pretty low, between 2 and 10 milligrams of fluoride a day, which is easily exceeded. There'll be people are within that range living in a fluoridated community. And meanwhile, we have an epidemic in this country of hypothyroidism. So this question then is raised, well, if fluoride lowers the activity of somebody with hyperthyroidism, what is it doing to somebody whose normal thyroid? Could it be producing hypothyroidism, or is it exacerbating the symptoms of somebody who's borderline hypothyroidism? Again, nobody in any fluoridated country has attempted to investigate this on a national level. The other issue which particularly concerns me and has for 17 years is the possibility that fluoride interferes with the development of the brain. We now have over 40 animal studies which shows that fluoride can enter the brain, concentrate in the brain, damage the brain, and 16 animal studies which shows fluoride can change behavior, and 36 studies which associate a lowered IQ in children and fairly modest exposure to fluoride. And 27 of those studies were recently reviewed in a meta-analysis by a team from Harvard University, two from Harvard University and two from China. And most of the studies were, in fact, in China. And as I said, the lowering of IQ is associated with fairly modest exposure to fluoride in some of the cases. For example, a threshold for one of the studies was 1.9 parts per million. And I've actually been to the villages in China where that study was done by Zhang. And 1.9 parts per million for a serious effect like lowering of IQ, and based upon a study of several hundred Chinese children, offers no margin of safety to protect every child in the United States when you've got a huge range of sensitivity or vulnerability to any toxic substance, when you've got a huge variation in genetics, in health status, nutritional status, lifestyle, and so on. You've got to have quite a large margin of safety to reach a safe level to protect everybody's brain. And we just don't have that margin of safety for kids drinking water at 1 part per million, or even at 0.7 parts per million, which is probably going to be the new recommended level to fight tooth decay. So 0.7, some children are drinking enough water at 0.7 parts per million, plus the fluoride they're getting from other sources, to exceed the doses that some of those children in China were getting at 1.9 parts per million. So you don't even protect against the potential range of doses, let alone the range of sensitivity.
Yeah. Now, how intentional is this, though? Because, I mean, I've heard for years, Paul, that the use of fluoride began also partially in the National Socialist concentration camps.
Yeah, don't go there.
No?
I don't go there. I recommend strongly that people do not use that information. Historically, it would not stand up. A historian would want more sources for that information than just the one source that we have. And meanwhile, it is really counterproductive and insulting, because by suggesting this, you're suggesting that these well-intentioned dentists and doctors out there who really think they're helping kids are actually part of some plot to dumb down the American public, or you know, to associate them with what the Nazis were doing is really, really insulting, and is not going to bring them over to our side. It's certainly not going to get them to engage in reading the scientific literature. And from a strategic point of view, it's a distraction which they will gladly take. Their promoters of fluoridation will gladly grab this distraction with both hands and label us all conspiracy theorists, which is what they want to do and perhaps what they need to do right now, because the science is not on their side. The science says that swallowing fluoride does not reduce tooth decay by anything but a very small amount by swallowing it. The science says it works topically, not systemically. And the science says there are dangers which offer where, for which there's no adequate margin of safety to protect everyone, including this very serious issue of lowering of IQ. And we should have learned by now that you don't mess around with neurotoxins and newborn babies. We think this is what happened when we had lead in gasoline, that we shifted the IQ over for the whole population by 5 IQ points. You get a whole shift in the IQ curve. Now, you wouldn't notice, a parent wouldn't notice, a school teacher wouldn't notice a shift of 5 IQ points for the average person. A drop from 100 to 95, a parent wouldn't notice it, a school teacher wouldn't notice it. You certainly wouldn't notice it walking down the street. However, if you did that shift, you'd halve the number of geniuses in your society, and you'd double the number of mentally handicapped. So that would have huge social and economic ramifications for a population like the United States. We cannot afford to do that. So once you've got any notion that fluoride may be lowering of IQ, especially as this is a practice which you can end by turning off a tap. I mean, there are many other more important environmental health issues out there than fluoride, but this is the only one that you can go to the public waterworks and turn off the tap, and it's over. And when you've got the potential that you may be lowering, shifting the IQ of the whole population over, you don't mess around, you use the precautionary principle, and you turn it off. And isn't this, we've got one IQ study, we've got 36 IQ studies from 4 different countries, from all different parts of China. The notion that, I mean, that I'm not saying the methodology of all those studies is perfect, it is not. There are weaknesses in nearly all of the studies, but there's a remarkable consistency here, and the authors of the meta-analysis done at Harvard University and published in Environmental Health Perspectives in July of 2012, they said, you know, it's hard to believe there's a confounder here like arsenic which would explain away these findings. 26 out of the 27 studies showed a lowering of IQ, and the average lowering of IQ was 7 IQ points, and they called for more research on this issue. But meanwhile, as I said, I think the precautionary principle should kick in, especially as the benefits that we are seeking here are very, very small. One, from swallowing fluoride. Two, there's a rational and better alternative of brushing your teeth with fluoridated toothpaste. There's an even better alternative, which is to use xylitol, a natural sugar, the xylitol toothpaste and xylitol mints to fight tooth decay, which they've been doing in Scandinavia and Japan for over 30 years.
So the question is, if this is done then, as you said before, Paul, with the well-intended intentions of helping those kids that, you know, drink too much soda pop and have too much corn syrup-drenched candy bars, what have you, then why is it that everyone should be subjected to it instead of then giving it to those few that, you know, believe that it works and want to have it? Everyone is dragged into this, at least in America. And later I want to talk about the other countries that are doing this as well, Paul.
Yeah. Well, of course, very few countries are doing this. 97% of Europe has rejected fluoridation. Japan doesn't fluoridate, India doesn't fluoridate, China doesn't fluoridate. So the vast majority of the population of the world does not fluoridate. Most of the people drinking fluoridated water live actually in the United States. We're the odd man out here. But why? Well, it's on an emotional level, it's appealing to believe that putting a little pixie dust in the drinking water magically helps us all fight tooth decay. However, the reality is quite different. If you go to cities in the United States which have been fluoridated for over 30 or 40 years, like Boston, Cincinnati, and Pittsburgh, and you name it, Cleveland, you'll find still a dental crisis. And that dental crisis is concentrated in low-income areas. And there's a far stronger relationship between tooth decay and income levels than you'll ever find between tooth decay and fluoride exposure. And so really what we should be doing, but it's appealing. You say we have to do this for equity. We have to give our poor people a chance at better teeth. And this is the way to do it. No, that's not the way to do it. Right now we have a situation where 80% of dentists in the United States will not treat children on Medicaid. So much for being concerned about poor kids, but most dentists will not treat them. Secondly, the ADA is fighting the use of dental therapists to provide much, much cheaper basic tooth treatment instead of dentists. So they're protecting their dentists from this incursion. But again, if you were really concerned about poor people, you would encourage expanding the service available to poor people. But the other reason why this emotional argument is unsatisfactory, in other words, we have to fluoridate to help poor kids, is because it's precisely low-income families which cannot afford avoidance measures. They cannot afford bottled water or reverse osmosis or what have you. So you trap this community. And the second reason that it's pernicious is because low-income families are more likely to have poor diet, and poor diet exacerbates fluoride's toxicity. This is well established in India. Low vitamins, low calcium, low magnesium, low protein intake exacerbates fluoride's toxicity. Wow. And this may be one of the reasons why the dental fluorosis rates are higher for black and Hispanic children in the United States than for white children. It may be because there's extra vulnerability of poor diet, maybe lactose intolerance, there may be other factors involved. And also, whilst we're at it, the people that should definitely not get any fluoride are people with kidney disease, kidney dysfunction, because the kidney gets rid, for a normal person, gets rid of about 50% of the fluoride that you take in each day, and the other 50% accumulates in the bones. But if you have poor kidneys, you may only get rid of 10% of the fluoride, and the other 90% accumulates in the bones. So whatever harm the fluoride can do to the bones is going to happen faster with people with kidney disease. And we have more kidney disease in minorities in the United States than in the mainstream.
In the next hour, Paul, I want to talk more about, you know, water, some of the alternatives and solutions to this. There's much more to cover, of course. But before we take a break and talk a little bit more about your book and the website, just one more thing about the sugar in all this as well, because it's almost in every single processed food these days. It's in fast food and everything else. The sugar lobby, you mentioned that before. That's something you want to talk a little bit about?
Yes, very quickly. In 1949, this is 1 year before the U.S. Public Health Service mysteriously endorsed fluoridation. And I say mysteriously because they started the trials in 1945. And these trials were meant to go on for 10 years. And halfway through these trials, the U.S. Public Health Service jumped in and endorsed fluoridation. No trials completed for effectiveness. And very little published data on safety, and yet they endorse fluoridation. Mysterious. Political, not scientific. 1 year before that mysterious event, the sugar lobby, representing 133 different sugar interests, the Sugar Research Foundation, said we need to find a way to reduce tooth decay without reducing sugar consumption. And they then proceeded to pour millions of dollars into nutrition departments at famous universities, especially Harvard University, where Dr. Fred Steyer, who was the chairman of that department, I think the department itself was set up with sugar money, went around the country extolling the virtues of both sugar and fluoridation, and in fact even described Coca-Cola as a nutritious drink. So yes, the sugar lobby have always been interested in having the magic bullet of fluoride to offset the notion that people would curb their sugar consumption to protect themselves from tooth decay. And so parents have taken their eye off the prize, as it were. And now we're paying two prices. Not only are we getting children's teeth ravaged by sugar, but we're also getting obesity. But the good side of that piece of information is what we need now is education, not fluoridation. We need to educate people to have a better diet, more vegetables, 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 especially for pregnant women. Better diet, better dental hygiene, more brushing, more flossing, etc. We should put this into schools. There are programs in Scotland and in Northern New Zealand right now where they have brushing lessons in class. They give them free toothbrushes and toothpaste and so on. So putting it into the classroom. Now, as far as financing that, the money should be there in spades because we should combine fighting tooth decay and fighting obesity by reducing sugar consumption, by taking out of schools all the fizzy drinks or the carbonated sodas and really getting parents to reduce their, you know, candy and all that other stuff that their kids are consuming in the ton loads.
Indeed, absolutely. We're talking with Paul Connett. He's the author of The Case Against Fluoride. And you can go to Amazon.com, for example, to pick up a copy and, of course, read more about all the things that we've been talking about so far. The website is called Fluoride Action Network. And give us the URL, Paul, and if there's anything else you want to mention about the website, what our listeners can find there.
Yeah, it's called the fluoridealert.org. The website is fluoridealert.org. The big thing for people to remember is to put the U before the O. It's think of flu, F-L-U-O. Many people spell it fluoride, F-L-O-U. Think of flu, F-L-U-O-R-I-D-E, fluoridealert.org. And a couple of things to draw people's attention to. There's two buttons at the top of the page. One is marked researches. If you click on researches, you get our whole health database, fluoride in 14 different tissues, and you can click on each tissue and find out all the literature which indicates that fluoride can harm these tissues. In some cases, you get links to whole papers, sometimes abstracts, a discussion, very comprehensive, all orchestrated by my son. And that includes, incidentally, about 46 studies that we've had translated from the Chinese, which before we translated them were not available to Western researchers. The other thing to click on there is videos. If you see videos, click on that. And there are many good videos that people will enjoy. An interview with Chris Bryson, if you're interested in the fluoride deception, the history of the collusion between the U.S. government and U.S. industry on fluoride pollution and fluoridation. And also, my favorite is a 28-minute videotape called Professional Perspectives on Water Fluoridation. I think this is the best tool that we have of educating people very quickly. And if people click on that and like it, they can download it and make as many copies as they want and give it to their dentists, their doctors, their friends, their neighbors. You don't have to argue about it. Just give it to people and say, look at this, and then we can talk about it later. And there are other videotapes that you could find there, but that's a good one. That Professional Perspectives has interviews, short snippets, from 15 scientists from around the world. Three members of the National Research Council, two former employees of the EPA, a Nobel laureate, Sir Ian Chalmers from England, several environmentalists, myself, a couple of dentists who were once pro fluoridation. So I think a range of people, with some of whom have enormous scientific substance, and they explain the arguments against fluoridation in fairly simple terms which most people can understand.
Very good. You're behind that video, by the way, the interview with Chris Bryson on the fluoride deception, correct?
Yes, that was the interview. My son was there. He organized it. I was the interviewer, but you only had to ask Chris a couple of couple of things, and he took care of the rest. It was one of the easiest interviews I've ever done in my life.
Well, it's an excellent video. It really nails it, and it's short to the point, so I recommend it to everyone. We're going to link it up, of course. So good job on that, Paul. But we'll take a short break here. We'll continue with more after this, so stay with us, everyone. We'll be right back.
They got me, Joe. The commies turned my son into a wolf. I don't know how they did it. Might have been something in the water. Fluoride. They say fluoride's good for your teeth. Did you get a load of his teeth? I heard about being long in the tooth, but that's just too long. Joe. Why didn't they listen to you back then when they had a chance?
In the second hour, Paul talks about the stigma behind those who oppose water fluoridation. Why aren't European scientists speaking up, although America is poisoning its water supply? Later, we talk about solutions, filtrations, and other alternatives, including what can be done to stop water fluoridation in your town or city. We have a members' website, redicemembers.com, where we gather all of our material, every single program going back to 2006. And when you want to hear the continuation of this or any of our programs, please sign up for a subscription and support an independent radio program that spares you from commercial interruptions, blinking website banners, and always puts the guest and the topic first. Try it out, sign up for a 3-month subscription, and download everything on the website if you so please. We have also TV episodes, films, videos, commentary, and even music. Before we proceed, I'd like to mention some of our upcoming programs. We have Ross Hamilton, Jim Vieira, and Hugh Newman with us for a roundtable on the very real and suppressed information about the ancient giants of the Americas. We also have Olle Damgård on the assassination of Olof Palme, Part 3, to wrap up that series. We have much more coming after this, and you're of course welcome to tune in again when we're back with more. You can stream or download whenever it suits you, use our mobile apps, or subscribe to our RSS feeds to get both radio and news right to you. More is coming up right now with Paul Connett on the fluoride fraud. Thank you for staying with us.